when it served. It's now my pleasure to welcome back to the CFO Forum someone many of you were Melbourneites will know, and if you don't, I'm sure you'll be going back to the office and clicking on crikey.com.au or the main report when you head back to the office. Stephen Mayne, to my right, is a Walkley Award-winning journalist who founded, built, and then sold Australia's best-known e-zine, crikey.com.au, which he continues to contribute to. And he now runs the Mayne Report, where you'll find under lists on the website one of his current projects, a growing list of foreign-owned subsidiary operations in Australia. Stephen is also one of probably Australia's best-known shareholder activists and one of our nation's most unsuccessful candidates. As you all know, brand and reputation are key issues for companies in building shareholder value, attracting new staff, customers, and retaining people. So we've asked Stephen to join us to discuss what, as an observer over many years and an activist, he feels that stakeholders really want out of today's companies. To make the most of his very broad knowledge of and experience in the world of politics, business and the media, though, I've broadened his brief, so basically Stephen's allowed to talk about whatever he'd like to. Stephen Mayne, professional gadfly, welcome back, and over to you.
Okay, thanks very much, Josie. Look, I'm glad you've all received the leave pass from Mick Gatto to attend today, seeing as he seems to run Melbourne at the moment. I'm going to cover hopefully a wide variety of topics for you and tell you a few things maybe you hadn't thought about before. Just to confirm how I am one of the most unpopular people in the country, there's a few comments that a few different people have made about me over the years. My personal favourite is Alan Jones. People like Stephen Mayne don't deserve a place in society. So, and Kerry Packer, all I asked Kerry Packer was whether he was losing money on Hoyts. And he said, you know, do you set out to be offensive or is it just natural? So often you can ask quite innocent questions. Like with Rupert, it was, have you got a contract, Rupert? And it was, you know, you're free to fire me any time, Mr. Mayne. So, Eddie's just, he was just asked by a journalist because I'd been writing about his conflicts of interest for a long time. And I was actually an old family friend of the Maguire family. I had stayed with them in Scotland. So he took it a bit hard and that I could dare to criticise him. So, I wouldn't cross the road to give him a backhander or a writ, which I thought was quite Gatto-esque almost. There's a full list of my public company board tilts. 27 failures. Not many people can claim to have had more than $200 billion worth of stock voted against them. As you can see, started off quite well in 2000, almost got on the Woolworths board with 55%. They used the undirected proxies to get me down there. Some quixotic platforms over the years, often with the financials, I'm running on a platform that they become more activist in their funds management. I'm out there trying to build a culture of shareholder pressure, and I think the big boys should actually be doing that. So I often run for financial boards, challenging them for when they've ever stood up at a meeting, when they've ever voted against a resolution, how active are they being. Took on all the companies doing cash for comment, like IAG, and the Combank, and basically kept running for their boards until they stopped paying protection money to Alan Jones and John Laws. I thought that was quite an effective campaign. And the most blatantly populist one was probably David Jones, that all shareholders get the same 35% shopping discount that the directors get. And that one got censored out, as you would not be surprised. And I've got a couple of tilts at the moment. I'm running for Illumina, which is I think Australia's second largest consumer of or emitter of greenhouse gases, and also running for the board of WA News. And I had a call from Grant Samuel this morning saying that Kerry Stokes has hired Corn Ferry to critique the 9 outside candidates running for the board of WA News. So can you please submit your CV? So this is the first time this has ever happened. So it's quite interesting. And run for a few other things. I managed to get the presidency of the Chess Club in 1988 unopposed. Third out of five in Jeff Kennett's old seat. So my original move from journalism, I worked at the Herald Sun, The Age, the Fin Review, and I've been a press secretary for Jeff Kennett, literally in the next building, and had 18 months there. And it was a very exciting time. So, I mean, I still think the most exciting government probably the world's ever seen in a stable democracy. I mean, think about what Jeff Kennett did. He flogged off $35 billion worth of assets. He was the first person since William of Orange to sack judges. He gave us the world's biggest casino, the world's biggest toll road. He closed 300 schools and he cut the health budget by 10%. He hounded the DPP out of office and he hounded the Auditor General out of office. I mean, and he got rid of 100,000 public sector workers from 260,000 to 160,000. So, by jingo, this was a heck of a thing to be involved in, I can tell you. And experiencing that, I left him thinking, well, that was pretty exciting, but I think he does cross the ethical boundaries occasionally. And I went back to the media, Fourth Estate, very important institution in any democracy, and continued to run, sort of increasingly ran questions about what Jeff was up to, and I guess I fell foul of him when I sort of revealed that he'd been buying shares in hot floats and putting them in his wife's name and not disclosing it to Parliament. He received a $400,000 defamation settlement from Kerry Packer, which was tax-free, which funded his $300,000 renovation at his home. And then hounding the DPP and the Auditor General and a few things like that basically made me reach the conclusion that he wasn't fit to be Premier. And I then tried running through the media channels, went on Four Corners, did the whistleblower number with them, went on Today Tonight. Nothing really worked because the media was pretty soft on Jeff because they loved his excitement and the guy saved Victoria. So I ran in his seat to try and published Jeff.com to try and draw attention to his behaviour. Was ruled ineligible, couldn't run. Then the Jeff.com was credited with having an influence with his defeat, and I basically traded off that for the next little period as the guy, and my slogan, oh, crikey, was bringing down government since September 1999. So then I sort of did a few other things there. You can see I ran for Melbourne Lord Mayor. I sort of became a bit of a token candidate. I ran for the RACV twice, which is Australia's biggest mutual, worth about $3 billion. And then I worked out that my wife beat me when she ran as my running partner in 2005. I worked out I wasn't really doing too well. So I worked out also that women got 20% more votes than men at the RACV, all things being equal. So she ran the next year and got elected. So my poor wife, who's a family law barrister, didn't know much about finance, suddenly found herself on the board of Australia's richest mutual. So that was my one other win. All my wins are vicarious, or the chess club, or the kinder, which I chaired for a year before moving on, didn't do much of a job with the kinder. And then with Costello, basically the platform there was a few things. Australia's the biggest gamblers in the world. We should be taking some steps at a federal level to get rid of poker machines. And we have the world's most expensive banking system. We basically have an oligopoly which gouges consumers outrageously, big and small. I'm sure all of you have experienced it. Ridiculous that financial services are 42% of the Australian stock market when the global average is 28% for financial services. All the numbers point to an outrageous oligopoly. So I ran against Costello saying, do something about the banks, and got 3%. And for the first time in any of my tilts, actually finished in the front 50% of the field. I came fourth out of eight. So there it was. Now, I want to talk a bit about Australian companies offshore. I sort of got into shareholder activism from a couple of points of view. One was, you know, we are the lucky country, we have the world's greatest dowry, we should be the world's richest nation in per capita earnings, we should be a middle weight in the region, doing well. We should have had a lot more population immigration over the years, given our vast, expansive space. And we should have a whole bunch of globally important companies, and we should, as a nation, be contributing to global institutions. And as a shareholder as a reporter going to public company AGMs, I would constantly find that companies would perform badly, that there was an old boys network which basically filled all the board seats of the major companies, you know, particularly you had to go to Melbourne Grammar in Melbourne. And when companies stuffed up, there wasn't any level of accountability, that BHP's old CEO, John Prescott, was able to make blunder after blunder for 7 years until 1998. With $10 billion written off from his various blunders. And there was very poor debate at the AGMs, very little voting against directors' re-elections, and a vast destruction of shareholder value. And I think it's quite telling that subsequently BHP's gone for three expat CEOs, or foreign CEOs, who've done a far better job than what the Melbourne club system managed to produce at BHP. Now, so I decided to track this more specifically. So I said, let's count up the number of companies that are doing well internationally, that are generating more than $200 million a year offshore. And there's only 81 of those that I can come up with, and I've listed a few of the best performers there. News Corp, I think the big four are probably Westfield, QBE, Macquarie and News Corp. They are the standout four Australian international success stories. There's a few others. CSL is emerging, particularly in blood products. There's some more niche players like Computershare, Cochlear. Aristocrat, it's a lamentable thing to say that, you know, we've produced the world's second biggest manufacturer of poker machines, but I guess it is a legitimate industry. And we're starting to do better on the mining services space, particularly the likes of Worley, Parsons, the engineering companies. And even James Hardy actually is a genuine success story, despite its disgraceful conduct in Australia, in building products, particularly in the US. So the question is, why is it that Australia can't produce more international success companies and internationally successful companies? And I think it goes back to that success in Australia tends to be, if you look at the successful companies, they tend to be service companies. They tend to be inwardly focused on Australia. So I say the banks, I say Woolworths, Coles, Telstra, and we have an unhealthy obsession with financial services, which I've mentioned, and property. And so we don't have enough of the, you know, and gaming, licensed gaming companies and licensed media companies. So the whole game for too long in Australia has been managing your regulatory relationship, your government relationship, to succeed. And Kerry Packer is the best example of that. I mean, he grew to be Australia's richest man, and he was just a brilliant gamer or manager of his regulatory relationships, whether it was casinos licensed by government, whether it was TV licenses licensed by government. And didn't ever really do much offshore. Rupert, to his great credit, did go offshore in a spectacular way and managed to manage various government relationships internationally brilliantly to build up a huge fortune. Now, in terms of your sector, foreign companies in Australia, I come up with more than 250 who are doing more than $200 million a year in revenue in Australia. And that's obviously three times the number of Australian companies doing $200 million a year offshore. And the biggest sectors, and I guess the inverse here is the sectors where Australian companies have not done very well. Pharma, consumer goods, IT, autos, financials, there are some big investors. Obviously, there's still our big banks, but there are still a large number of financial major investors in Australia, most notably GE, which has got more than $10 billion in Australia. And I think the worst sector of all, in terms of if you're taking a slightly patriotic Australian view, is the resources sector. And the harsh reality of that is that, and I've listed more than 50 major resource projects in Australia which are majority foreign owned. And most of the really, really big investors in Australia are in the $10 billion club are in the resources space. Rio, Shell, Xstrata, Mitsui, Mitsubishi, the Singapore government, Chevron, Texaco, the Chinese government's got about $20-25 billion invested in Australia. The Singapore government has about $35 billion invested in Australia. Quite an amazing stat that there are two foreign governments with bigger investment pools in Australian operating businesses than the Australian government. So if you total up the value of the residual stake in Telstra, the value of Aussie Post, and you add that against everything that, say, Singtel and Australand and SP AusNet, etc., has, it's quite an amazing statistic. And I often look at the Brits. My dad's British. And I look at the Brits and I say, how does a little nation like that do so well and so international? And I look at, say, six companies and I say, where are the Australian equivalents of these six companies? And it's GlaxoSmithKline, great global pharma company. BP, where's Australia's oil major? I mean, BP does $16 billion in revenue in Australia alone, and it's a global giant. Cadbury Schweppes, global fast-moving consumer goods company. Australia really doesn't produce much in the way of fast-moving consumer goods beyond Foster's. British America Tobacco, Intercontinental, obviously not so big as the others. And so what are the Australian, what are the well-known Australian brands internationally? And I think you can probably say Qantas is the big one. I think you probably say Foster's, although amazingly Foster's actually sells a pretty small amount of beer. And after that, you're talking Billabong and a few other more minor players, but we really haven't produced much in the way of fast-moving consumer goods companies. I think it is quite amazing. I've got a few more points here on why Australia hasn't performed as well as we should have. Being at the foot of Asia, it's amazing that we've never had a single scandal in Australia for Asian sweatshop labour. I mean, if you think about Phil Knight and Nike and all those, you know, who's doing the sweatshops in China. I'm not saying Australian companies should do it, but I'm saying that the fact that we've never even had a public scandal or even a public mention of any company doing anything wrong in Asia actually makes a separate point, which is that our companies haven't really gone into Asia and built globally known consumer brands with Asian manufacturing, as so many other countries have done. So we've really missed that whole cheaper sourcing from Asia boat. Pacific Dunlop used to be the biggest and basically stuffed it up at a whole range of levels and has been broken up into a million pieces, and the residual is now called Ansell. And even our big banks, ANZ now has a mission to be a super regional power, but surely by now our banks are all capitalised, even after taking a $100 billion market cap haircut in the last 4 months. They're all still capped at more than $50 billion. Surely from that level of platform, you should have been able to build some form of pan-regional banking franchise to speak of, to take on the likes of, you know, Hong Kong, Shanghai Banking Group and those likes. Amazing that we are the world's biggest island without a shipping company to speak of. Amazing that we are a huge tourism country, both in the way we tour and the way tourists come here. We have no hotel brand to speak of at all. And I think, in trying to explain it, I think there is still a go-to-the-beach culture in Australia, that we're too focused on leisure and sport. From my point of view, we lack a culture of shareholder pressure. And I'll talk a bit about my experiences, that if we had a culture of shareholder pressure, we might have done a bit better on a whole range of these fronts. Corporate power is way too concentrated. You know, show me an airline which is as powerful as Qantas in its domestic market. Show me a telco which is as integrated and as powerful as Telstra in its domestic market. Show me a company which is the equivalent of News Corp, which has 70% of the newspaper market. Show me a Westfield in another market where they've got the majority of the shopping centres. That we don't have in the ACCC or in its previous bodies forced divestiture laws, which are standard and often used in the UK and the US. So that the likes of Standard Oil can be broken up when they become too powerful. And in Australia, that's never been the way. And we do have simply too much concentration of corporate power. And I think also we need more of an entrepreneurial spirit, that the whole crash of the 80s when all the entrepreneurs went down actually was a net negative, because it really did dampen the aspirations of a generation of younger Australians who looked at that and said, oh, business guys, they're crooked. Look at the Alan Bonds of the world. My aspiration is to go to uni and get a job in a big bank and not go out there and make it. Like in America, you know, it's almost, if you've been bankrupt in America, it's a badge of honour. In Australia, it's a point of disgrace. So, and I think big government, we also, quite amazing, I think, have a terrible federal-state system. I don't think there's another country in the world which has a bigger second tier of government than Australia. If you think about everything the states do, it is phenomenal, their scale of their operations, with the one major and very important exception, which is revenue raising. So we have a very lopsided system where the feds do little, sod all, and raise all the cash, and the states do the vast majority of the heavy lifting. No other country in the world has a federal government that doesn't spend a dollar on public transport, which is what Australia has, which is a pretty unusual situation. And I think you've got to cut to the chase here as well, that domination and union power has been something that's held back Australia's business development, I think, in a fairly substantial way over the years. And I'd put to you that Australia today has the world's most powerful union movement. And that's because we have all of all Labor governments. We have a gerrymander which has the unions controlling 50% of the votes in all Labor Party forums. So it's not a one vote, one value system. And we have 70% of the union, as you've heard a million times, 70% of the current Labor front bench federally is union background. And between them, the Labor parties and their various state branches and their various affiliated unions have more than $1 billion of assets. The CFMEU alone has $100 million of assets. The Queensland Labor Party has more than $100 million worth of assets, whereas their pro-business, smaller government rival, Liberal parties, would struggle to have $100 million of assets between them, dwindling membership, broken, never been more depleted than right now. So we do still, from this system, get a reasonably centrist and managerial governments at the various different levels. Don't get too many crazy left-wing disasters like we had pre-Kennett in Victoria, but I still think it is a fact that few people don't recognise that this is just the reality of Australia. And things like actually having more substantial immigration, building up the size of the population, flexible labour, doesn't happen because of the whole wage parity, union power thing which intervenes, that prevents Australia from being a little bit more like Asia in terms of those sorts of issues. I want to talk a bit about the irony of the fact that we can't produce enough global successful companies out of Australia, and there's a whole range of reasons for that, tyranny of distance being one of them, but Aussies get to the top of other major global companies more effectively and more often than any other small nation. So how is it that Australians can run McDonald's, Philip Morris, Allied Domecq, Coke, British Airways, Rentokil, Campbell Soup, Ford, Reuters, and these are just the former guys in the last 20 years. That is an amazing portfolio of major global companies that have been run by Australians. And the next slide is Aussies now at or near the top. Obviously Rupert, we've got the Andrew Liveris as the CEO of Dow Chemical, David Mackay is running Kellogg's, Philip Bowman has previously run Scottish Power, and Allied Domecq is now running Smiths out of London, Richard Goodmanson, we've got the second in charge at DuPont, and a number of others there. So we amazingly seem to be able to produce people who can rise up the ranks. And I think, why is that? I think that's one, Australia's off the travel, but there's a lot of young Australians who finish university and go off and find their way in the world. And then Australians are so used to that, we haven't got any hang-ups about our culture and our history. We're a very secular society. We get on well with people. We're relaxed. We're easygoing. We mingle well. And people don't find us offensive. They don't say, oh, you're an Aussie. I don't like you because you're of a particular religion or you're in a particular war that we didn't like. And and we are an industrious people. And so when we get a chance to show our stuff and throw it into the world, our individuals do very well in rising up. And my whole challenge is, why can't we do this more institutionally within Australia with our corporates? And what changes could we see to improve that? Because the other great irony is that we have so many foreign CEOs, and when I talk to this audience, of course, I'm not saying anything bad about having foreign CEOs or multinationals here, but it's an amazing statistic that no other country in the world has 8 of their top 10 companies run by expats. So look at the list there. BHP, Telstra, NAB, ANZ, Combank, Woodside, Westpac and Rio all have expat CEOs. So there's a bit of a cultural cringe right at the very top of corporate Australia in the boardrooms, which says that the local management doesn't cut it. To make it, we have to import the big name CEO from somewhere. And I think it probably goes back to the BHP issue, which is the one that sticks in everyone's mind, which is a succession of poorly performed Australians ran it into the ground. Australia, you know, pretty much surrendered its position, which it should have been as a really powerful dominant force in resources, mismanaged so many of the assets, the dowry, lost control of so much of it with incompetent management, and at the end of the day, it wasn't going to happen again at the highest level. And I'm surprised it still happens within the banks so much. That, you know, banks are very domestically focused. They're not like a BHP or a Rio. In the case of Telstra, it was we didn't think the Aussie guys did it, so we've got to go to the big name American to try and fix things up. The only two Australian companies in the top 10 run by Australians are Frank Lowe at Westfield and Michael Luscombe at Woolworths. This is not a phenomenon that bats down the list, though, because I can only come up with another 7 of the top 100 companies that have expat CEOs. So Lendlease, Amcor, Santos, and actually there's a mistake in that slide. Kirby Adams has now retired, and Paul O'Malley is an Australian who's running BlueScope still. And I've missed one, which is Jeremy Sutcliffe from Sims. So it is still 7. But 8 of the top 10 and only 15 of the top 100 have bring in expat CEOs to run Australian listed companies. So it's quite an unusual trend there that's concentrated just at the top of the sector. I want to talk briefly about some climate change issue and the environment. I think that it's fair to say that the global push on the climate change is, I think there's a big factor in that it's coming from the investment community. I think Goldman Sachs' involvement in the Carbon Disclosure Project as a chief sponsor and pusher of that has been quite powerful. I think what happened with TXU in Texas was a phenomenal moment or a phenomenal example of climate change becoming a dominant and preeminent issue. Was in Texas, you had a Republican governor who wanted to push through a whole bunch of new power plants, 19 of them. The governor was Rick Perry, in great haste, working in cooperation with the local dominant utility, TXU, which used to be the monopoly and then became a bit of an international player. And there was an unusual coalition of ranchers, local mayors and environmentalists who opposing this massive, fast, excessively overdone rollout of 90 new coal plants, and persuaded a coalition of private equity firms sponsored by Goldman Sachs, including KKR and TPG, to buy out TXU for $45 billion, remove the CEO and wind back the rollout of the coal plants. So this was a phenomenal, you know, you think about climate change skepticism, you think ExxonMobil, you think Big Oil, you think Texas, you think that would be the global heart of it. So what happened at TXU was, I think, a phenomenal development in the emergence of investor power on this issue. Britain, I think, is leading the world in the whole climate issue. The way the Stern report, the impact the Stern report had in Australia was phenomenal. Al Gore scared the bejesus out of the punters. Stern scared the bejesus out of the government and the business community, and that changed the metrics and the dynamics in Australia in a major way and made climate change a huge bogey around John Howard's neck last year, which I think was a significant factor in his defeat. You've even got Walmart on the case post-New Orleans doing a few things more on climate change. And I think for an audience of CFOs, I probably should say that in the Australian context, only 10 of the top 200 listed companies in Australia have fully disclosed their liabilities from carbon. And some surveys have shown that if there was a $30 a tonne tax on greenhouse emissions on carbon, that 43 of the top 200 in Australia would have an adverse profit impact of more than 5%. In other words, it would be material. So I think that in Australia, there hasn't been as much cooperation with the CDP project as there probably should have been, and that for a group of CFOs like yourself, I presume that your companies are all thinking about it, but you've got to obviously be on top of the numbers, and then you've got to wrestle with the integrity of the numbers, which I agree and accept is an issue which is still open to debate. But as a shareholder activist who totally relies on public information, I have to tell you that disclosure, I think, is vital in this debate, and we need all the cards on the table. So I'd encourage you to all accept the phrase sunlight is the best disinfectant, and have an approach which is warm and open to disclosing when it comes to your own carbon liabilities that potentially loom. In terms of other stakeholder groups in Australia, I think that we have one of the worst and least engaged and least effective consumer movements in the world in Australia. I don't know if any of you have ever had consumer groups coming at you, I'd be surprised. Choice is a fairly limp organisation. The Australian Consumers Association isn't particularly effective. In Australia, the political environment is basically organised labour, Labour Party, and big and small business, more big business, represent the Liberal Party, and the National Party represent the farmers. There is no constituency at a political level for consumers. And unlike countries like the UK, which have very powerful and well-organised consumer groups, we do not have a culture of consumer engagement. Part of that goes back to the fact that so many of our consumer schemes are state-run, and we have a sort of a bit of a botched process in terms of how that all operates. And for mine, the best example of a lack of consumer movement is the way our banks have been able to blindly rip off their consumers, particularly with fees, which you've all copped, which are just quite outrageous in terms of the profits they're generating, and there hasn't been any substantial consumer backlash, organised backlash against the banks. So I think that is a bit of an unfortunate thing about Australia. We have a very well-organised green movement. If you look around the world, our green movement is well-organised. I think we have the world's best organised labour movement. It just happens to be where the power resides in Australia. Other specific lobbies, such as the gay lobby, incredibly effective and well-organised in terms of the achievements they've done in areas like HIV. But in my space of shareholders, it's been pretty woeful. And the statistic that I always cite as to why there was absolutely no culture of shareholder engagement or shareholder pressure in Australia is the fact that Rupert Murdoch had one question in 7 years before I came along. So the world's most powerful man gathered with his shareholders in Adelaide 1991 to 1998 and was asked one question. And that is just pathetic. And you do need, as a stakeholder group, us shareholders have been hopeless. Now, it is getting better, slowly, over time. There's a few things that are happening which I'll get to. I want to talk briefly also about corporate social responsibility, which or ESG, which is something which is coming up a lot. Again, the Brits are leading the world. Most advanced debate, you read the British press and watch the TV over there, and they are absolutely ahead of the game in terms of corporate social responsibility. You've got the corpse law in the UK is actually written in corporate social responsibility as an area which directors have to take into account in the way they run their companies. I think you are going to see some significant progress in Australia under Kevin Rudd. And the most important area for multinationals, I think, is on the supplier front. I think that in terms of testing your suppliers for their adherence to CSR principles is probably the area where you're seeing a fair bit of focus on this. I want to also briefly touch on the current collapses and what it means from a shareholder point of view, because I think that I actually think this is a great opportunity for shareholder pressure, because I think that what's happened is a complete disgrace. And so many of these collapses have appalling governance that I think that with a new government in power, that this is going to be a unique opportunity for some legislative change and for some cultural change to drive better debate. Orco Finance Group, just executive chairman, massive related party transactions. Luminaries on the board, like Sir Rod Eddington, but Sir Rod Eddington is the busiest man in Australia. He has 11 different gigs. He cannot possibly be across the enormous intricacies and complexities of the Orco Finance Group. I'm an investor in all 10 Orco-listed vehicles. I put my standard $500 into each of them, which I do in every listed company of note. So I own shares in 650 companies, not even worth 170 grand, the world's biggest small share portfolio. And they are all down. All my Orco investments are down by between 80 and 90%. All of them. So it is a complete fiasco. And they have lost many billions of dollars of investors' money. And I think there will people will go to jail for what happened at Orco. Although I do worry a bit about ASIC's record on this front, because I do keep lists of who ASIC has sent to jail as a sort of a KPI on the corporate plot in terms of how vigilant they have been. And in 2007, they had their second worst year in a decade, and they only managed to lock up 17 people. And the majority of those were the proverbial financial planner from Tookaruk who stole 20 grand from his grandma. So I'm hoping that we see a far more vigorous ASIC come out of this current spate of collapses, and I think there's a fair chance we will. MFS, again, is a disgrace. What you'll see from MFS is a series of massive related party transactions and basically a bunch of dodgy White Shoe Brigade lawyers and property developers from the Gold Coast paying massive commissions to financial planners, hoovering up vast sums of money from gullible investors, retirees, etc., with conflicts and kickbacks running everywhere. I think you're going to see a massive backlash against the conflicted financial planner sector as a result of this, particularly given that the Labor Party is in bed with the industry funds, which some of you probably deal with, which are controlled by the unions, which do not pay commissions to anyone and hate financial planners. So the financial planners are not going to have a very good time in the way ahead because of the political changes in Canberra and because of the disgraces that all happened at MFS. Centro, less disgraces, but outrageous to have a one parent company board sitting here and a listed trust sitting here with an identical board of directors. Of course, you've got to have some separate independent directors on the separate listed vehicle. And big issues for the auditors there because they weren't consolidating the accounts. And same with Orco, missed billions in short-term debts which weren't disclosed. ABC Learning, it's almost symptomatic of the Australian way, isn't it, that the most subsidised company in the country, ABC Learning, $1 million a day out of Canberra. You know, you've got to be close to the government, so 6 months after he leaves as children's minister, Larry Anthony joins the ABC Learning board, that sort of classic, you know, the guy who was giving us all the government handouts, we'll get him on the board now. We've conquered Australia, therefore we can conquer the world, we'll just roll out the same model, doesn't quite work that way, and the company's come a cropper. The former milkman, Eddie Groves, loves flying his choppers, is looking after more kids in the world than anyone else, has lost his fortune, and blamed short sellers, which is a load of bollocks because the ABC Learning share price is still at exactly the same level today that it was sent to by these short sellers. If his argument had any merit, the stock would be back at $4. And Eddie basically has blown more than $1 billion of money and should be out of a job, but who knows how to run a global childcare company. Macquarie Fortress is just people would never mention it. Somehow Macquarie is just bulletproof, and as the guy who came up with the nickname Millionaire's Factory a decade ago, I always feel obliged to talk a bit about Macquarie. They've blown $250 million in a listed vehicle called Macquarie Fortress, which basically geared up to 90% and bought US bonds, and they've blown a lot. So they have had a fund blow up in exactly the same scale of losses as the other ones mentioned there. Opus Prime, I think, is going to be the one that causes the major trigger of the crisis of confidence in our system. Again, only in Australia could you have be the first country in the world to float the stock exchange on itself, to have a regulator trading on itself. A nation that where government largesse dishes out super profits to the privileged people who run these monopolies and government-sanctioned concessions No better example than the ASX, 400-fold return for the original stockbrokers who paid $25,000 for a membership of the ASX. $25,000 has turned into $5 million for those lucky people, and all the while they've been allowing anything goes on the stock market because they clip the ticket on every single short-selling, CFD, dodgy listed stock. They clip the ticket and make more profit. So one thing's going to happen, I'll bet you London to a brick, that the ASX will be stripped of their regulatory powers before the end of the year, and Opus Prime will be the thing which is held out for that, because they licensed Opus Prime and all this crazy stock lending and non-enforcement of margin calls that was going on. People are looking for someone to blame. They're going to blame the ANZ Bank and they're going to blame the stock exchange. And so ASIC will get to take over the ASX's roles. I had lunch with the head of regulation at the ASX last week. They're on a, or 2 weeks ago, they're on a PR offensive doing the rounds of all the journalists. And he told me they would die in a ditch to keep their regulatory powers, but that was just before Opus happened. So I can tell you that he'll be dead in a ditch, because they're going to lose their regulatory powers. I think the other thing we're going to see is third-party infrastructure funds. The Macquarie model, the Babcock model, is dead for all money. I think they're all trading at 30-40% discounts to net tangible assets. Terrible governance in those vehicles, because the likes of Macquarie Airports and Macquarie Infrastructure Group get paid massive transaction fees to buy up assets around the world. And there's a report that's just come out from a group called Risk Metrics, which is a very powerful proxy advisor, basically pointing out all the fees and conflicts. So I think that you can't sustain things trading at 30-40% discounts in the net asset backing. So Babcock's and Macquarie have got some serious problems in terms of their business models. The AGM reformers, I can tell you, I don't repeat this because this is sort of a Chatham House thing, but there's a move afoot to decouple the formal voting at AGMs from the actual debate. ASIC, the ASX, are in the tent, I'm in the tent, on putting a proposal to government that tries to make AGMs more lively. And I can tell you, AGMs in Australia have been a bit of a joke for a long time. And it's because we all gather after the voting's been done. So it's the equivalent of the Davis Cup dead rubber. You think about it. It's the equivalent of Rudd and Howard debating on the Monday after the election, because 99% of the votes are all cast by proxy 48 hours before the meeting, and then you all come along to have a debate, and we all know that 99% have supported all the resolutions. So the proposal is to keep voting open until 48 hours after the meeting, so that it becomes a live meeting. So if a chairman comes out with a shock profit warning or is rude to shareholders or something, you can still go back and revoke your proxy, you can change your vote, you can vote based on what happened at the AGM. That would seriously energise AGMs. And the big reform I'd love to see would be shareholders being able to put up more resolutions, because if you want to have a culture of shareholder pressure, you've got to let shareholders to speak, obviously, which is what I do, to run for boards, which I do because I can't put up resolutions. Because in Australia, to put up a resolution, you've got to have 100 signatures. To do it from shareholders. Who's got time to round up 100 shareholder signatures on the one piece of paper? Wet signatures. So, in America, you only need $2,000 for the shares to get a resolution up. So last year, I put up a resolution for Rupert Murdoch in New York to end his gerrymander. So basically, you go one vote, one value. I always say to Rupert, you're running a gerrymander that would make Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen blush. Why don't you give everyone the vote rather than 70% of the shares not having a vote? Your stock could get a re-rating. If you take up a premium, it'd be fantastic. No, I'm a dynastic kind of guy. I want to hand over to my kids. I'm going to keep this locked up. So I put the resolution up, one vote, one value. $5 billion worth of stock supported it, 60% of the independents, global press all over the world. This is one guy who lives in Templestowe in Melbourne, owns $2,000 worth of shares, puts up a resolution, flies to New York, takes on the world's most powerful guy, and gets a massive protest vote and puts serious pressure on Rupert to improve his governance. Can't do it in Australia because I can't get 100 signatures, I haven't got the time and resources to do it. So there's a whole bunch of really little simple reforms which would actually help to contribute to have a greater culture of shareholder pressure in Australia. Now, I've probably gone over time, so there's a few more things. I'm running for boards, as I said. The other way that people get you voted off boards or keep you off boards is what's called the no vacancy rort, where a typical board will say, I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, there's no vacancy. And therefore, 50% is not good enough, you've got to knock off one of the incumbents. And of course, incumbents average 98%. So I've worked out that when you combine that with what's called undirected proxies, which again is another rort, and the equivalent here is if you were voting on polling day last year and you went into the polling station and you said, I don't want to vote for John Howard Earn. I'm just going to say, yes, I'm here, and I'm going to put an empty ballot paper into the ballot box. In corporate elections, that defaults to the chairman. So a blank one defaults to the chairman, and the chairman typically holds 10% of the votes through this default system. So I've worked out that in 18 of my 27 tilts, if I'd got 100% of the votes in favour, I still would have lost, because I wouldn't have knocked off the worst performing incumbent because of the no vacancy rule, who would have got, say, 98%, because the chairman would then use the 10% of undirected proxies to get me down to 90% and say, sorry, Mr. Mayor, 100% wasn't good enough. So I just say to the corporates, come on. We have a sensible modern democracy here. We don't have these sort of third world rorts in our politics. We've got to clean up corporate elections in Australia. What are you running from? I'm never going to get elected anyway. Don't be so defensive. Just run free and fair elections. 50% is good enough. No undirected proxies and things like that. So I think we've got a fair way to go on the culture of shareholder pressure, although I would say on executive pay that I think that Costello's non-binding vote was one of the best things he did, and that the market for executive pay debate in Australia is working very well. Companies are now dealing with the issue. They're presenting detailed reports explaining it, and the shareholders are voting some of these reports down. So there is an informed market, there's discussion, there's engagement. A couple of things that aren't happening on executive pay is that boards are not scenario testing the performance hurdles. So we're not getting the, well, if the iron ore price doubles, Chip Goodyear will make too much without having done anything. Therefore, his short-term incentive shouldn't be affected by that. So I know there have been surveys of boards where virtually none of them are scenario testing the incentive payments, which I think is something they should be doing. And I think Josie mentioned earlier about the key challenges of attracting staff, and I think that it is readily apparent that companies that do have poor corporate governance or breach community standards on issues like corporate social responsibility are having to increasingly pay a premium to attract good technical and professional staff, and that it is a really good investment to have a good brand based on your place in your community. And if you have that good brand, you're regarded as a well-performing company which is operated ethically, you will find it more easy to attract quality people. And I think there is a very strong business case, therefore, for embracing your stakeholders and being seen to be companies which are engaged with your stakeholders and operating with them, and not being more combative and traditional, like, say, the old TXU, Exxon sort of James Hardy model, which I think now is increasingly discredited. So thanks for listening. I hope I haven't gone over too many diverse topics for you there, and I'm happy to take as many tough questions as you like, because on the internet, there's no rules on the internet. You can say what you like. I've lost my house from defamation, but apart from that, you can usually say what you like. There's no press council like the newspapers have. There's no broadcasting authority like the TVs have. So I find tough questions in these sort of forums is a good way of holding me to account as well. So feel free to fire off on any topic you like, and thanks very much for listening.
Thanks. Well, I said wide ranging, so we've got 10 or 15 minutes for questions, so I'll open it up. You've stunned them.
Stunned silence.
Oh, yeah, Mark.
Hi, Stu. I was just interested about the police culture thing. I mean, I'm very Melbourne with that. So, I mean, how do you reconcile that with OECD studies that show Australians as second out of the US in terms of the number of hours they work each year? Now, that's one point. The other thing about the global, about the Australians doing very well in global companies and yet the CEOs being global in Australia, I just wonder whether that's two sides of the same coin, which is the sort of global search for talent and meritocracy that the front has put in place with country-based funds. I suppose the third one is a difficult question, but why were the institutional investors so patient?
Well, I think that I'll answer the first one, the third one last, that the problem is that we have the world's most concentrated financial sector. So there's no other country in the world where the big banks are also a majority of funds management. So in Australia, the same people running debt are running equity. And you see the problems that arise with Opus, where the genetic disposition of a bank to seize and dispose always comes to the fore. And should that same bank be also running tens of billions of dollars of third-party funds, for super funds, which is what our banks do. You know, CommBank and Westpac and NAB in particular, between them run more than $300 billion. So the problem is that we have the same group of directors sitting on the same group of boards who both run the money that vote on the companies and run the companies. So back in the 1990s when BHP was blowing up billions of dollars, you had common directors between BHP and AMP. You had, Don Argus, even today, sits on the big JB Weir Fund, which always votes in favour of the board. And for mine, the classic example of this was the BHP Billiton merger, which was a shocking deal, which even at the time was a $5 billion transfer of value to Billiton. Now, given the way all the various commodity prices have moved and the fact that the BHP assets are so much better than the Billiton assets, the estimates are it's cost BHP shareholders about $30 billion, and their stock price would be $70 or $80. If they hadn't merged with Billiton. There was a number of shareholders that wanted to vote against, Colonial being the biggest, with 3% of BHP. But Colonial's chairman, ultimately, was John Ralph, chairman of the Commonwealth Bank, and John Ralph was a BHP director. And John Ralph is taking out full-page ads in the Fin Review saying, we urge all shareholders to vote against, to vote in favour of this deal, this is a great deal. So the poor Colonial fund manager is sitting there going, I hate this deal, but I'm going to embarrass my chairman if I vote for it, changed his mind, voted in favour, got through by a short margin. So I think that you need a church and state separation between the boards and the executives running the companies and the people running the money and voting to hold them to account. And that's something that we just haven't had in the past. So I think that the directors' club being too short, too many cross-directorships has been a big part of the problem. You're right about the statistics on the working hours. And I think that points to a separate phenomenon in Australia, which is the keeping up with the Joneses phenomenon, and people who in the consumer culture. I think the most amazing statistic about Australia at the moment is that we're currently riding the world our best ever terms of trade boom, and we're running our worst ever current account deficit. So even with the world paying us record prices for our goods, we're borrowing $80 billion from the rest of the world a year to consume, and that is what the Reserve Bank is trying to stop at the moment. So sucking in the plasma TV, you know, just the whole keep up with the Joneses thing is an important part of the culture. I think that the go to the beach culture, when I refer to that, I think maybe I should rephrase that as maybe giving a toss or giving a stuff. That Australia, you know, you lost a bit of money, oh well, doesn't matter, mate. She'll be right, mate. That'll be good enough. So we do work hard, although we do have, you know, more public holidays than most countries. I think that our institutionalised labour has negotiated very good, attractive terms of engagement. But it's that whole thing about just that lack of engagement and caring about things happening in the world. That Australians are interested in their local community, in their consumer culture, what's happening with their friends, and are not particularly engaged on civics and world affairs, and from my point of view, on good corporate governance. You know, no one gets excited at the Cricket Club about good corporate governance, do they? Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah, that's right. Well, the mobile phone, Telstra provides an appalling service. Your average wait's 45 minutes, but I'll stay with Telstra. The biggest single thing that has made the banks rich in Australia, there's been two phenomena. One is the debt-funded consumer binge. We've got $1 trillion of debt and the banks clipping the ticket. And the other one is the consumer apathy. Is that we're all so entangled with our banks and we just can't be stuffed moving from our banks. So the bank keeps on ripping us off by putting up new fee, and consumer apathy, can't be stuffed, too busy to change, and everyone's getting ripped off blind because there's no consumer movement out there going, you know, enough.
So who's doing well? You know, if you were to single out,
corporates?
Two or three corporates?
Well, I think I love, something, industries where it's not just your local, easy, privileged place in the market, like a Telstra. So QBE, spectacular global international insurance success story. Macquarie Bank, I bagged them for their governance, but I have to say that to become the world's biggest owner of infrastructure assets and effectively one of the world's biggest private equity firms from Martin Place in Sydney is a phenomenal effort. And I think it goes to the very basics of their remuneration model, which is hire the best honours graduates and put them on these huge incentive schemes and give them latitude to work within boundaries. and a brilliant risk management culture, and they basically tapped the global credit boom brilliantly, locked in their debt 5-7 years, so they hedged their debt brilliantly, so they're not exposed so much. And for me, the crowning glory for Macquarie Bank, in why I say I admire them, even though I think their model is stuffed, was any Australian company that can buy Rome Airport, trade it 3 years later and make $1 billion clear, you know, to go into the heart of the Roman Empire and make $1 billion from little old Sydney is just a phenomenal effort. So I think Macquarie, huge fan of theirs. And Frank Lowy, you've got to take your hat off to Frank Lowy. I mean, he games the system, big political donations, he can work the councils, he's worked the unions, he can manage all his stakeholders, but at the end of the day, they've got a brilliant skill, which is construction design. That's a great skill they've got, and Lendlease used to have it, lost it for a bit, is getting it back now, but it's a great skill. And then I think the Worley Parsons of the world, that we don't produce enough engineers, and we've blown it on the mining space. We haven't got a global oil company, which we should have. We haven't got a global gold company, which we should have. But we are doing very well on the resources services side. And Worley Parsons, I think, are the pinup boys there. Floated at $2 5 years ago. Now 40-odd bucks, and two billionaires out of that, and a great story. So, wish there were more of them.
I'm really going to ask a question. I thought it was fantastic. I was thoroughly entertained for the last 45 minutes. Particularly with the criticised and such like. But if business is in the making, basically everyone's in business to make a profit, getting back in banks. I really find a bit of a conflict of interest there. From a shareholder's perspective, we're sort of saying, well, how are we doing, like from a corporate governance perspective, you want to go wide, but what experience would you have for a board that would assist in enhancing the shareholder value? Is it to ask the hard questions? Is it to break up the boys' club? What value do you give to my board?
Well, based on my performance on the kindergarten board, not very much. My proposition is not actually that I will add anything to a board. My proposition is that I would rather put up resolutions. I'm a change agent. I'm trying to create a culture of shareholder pressure. I would go to AGMs and ask questions, and because I have a fairly adversarial relationship with the press, well, sections of the press, particularly the Murdoch press, because I'm always bagging Rupert, I used to get written out of the story. So my challenge was, how do I, and for me, publicity is the key thing, because I'm trying to create attention. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. I'm trying to shine sunlight on certain areas, and I need the megaphone of the press to do that. So I started running for boards as a way of directly doing that more effectively. But only on a couple of occasions have I actually seriously said I would be useful for this board. And I think I would be useful for the board of WA News, because I'm a newspaper journalist, and they've got problems with their state government and this sort of stuff. I think I could add a bit of value to a funds management board because of the governance and the voting and that sort of stuff. But, I'd be useless on most boards.
Going back to the Helsing days with Jeffrey Kennett and such like, how do you think you would have assisted him with his drug issue at Hawthorne?
If I was on the board of Hawthorne?
Well, no, assisting Jeffrey in the public relations side of things.
You have to remind me what he actually did in the end. With Hawthorn.
Well, Hawthorn, there's an issue whereby their players failed to provide appropriate samples at the time of drug testing.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just wondering whether you can see that to be a public issue, or Jeff should take that a bit more closely.
Well, if they failed to abide by the rules, I think one of Jeff's fundamental flaws was his lack of respect for the rules. So I think that I would have been counselling him to take a harder line to get the culture right, to ensure adherence to the club's code of conduct and the rules that they're applying. So,
I appreciate
that. Yeah.
So. It's 10 years since Corrigan had to get up to the forefront.
That and the GST were the two last great reforms in Australia, I think, in terms of the Howard government really lost it in the last few years. I thought Corrigan's comment was absolutely spot on and quite hysterical there a couple of nights ago when he said the Wharfies had a minute's silence and Corrigan said we should have an hour's silence for the 50 years of industrial thuggery which ripped off working families. I mean, the way he used Rudd's working families was just beautiful. That was a vital reform. The way they achieved it, I think, reflected the reality of the union thuggery, that it just had to be a pretty hard way. I think that the disappointing aspect of that in the end was that a union rip-off then became a business duopoly rip-off. and that we needed some more competition on the walls. We needed a third party. So that duopoly then became the traditional business scene in Australia. Two players making fat profits, gouging, charging the customers too much. So I think the follow-up there needed to be more competition and more benefit of the efficiency gains passed through the consumer, and the inclusion of the consumer in the debate, which so often doesn't happen in Australia. But I think Howard should be rightly quite proud of that, and even the Labor guys admit that it was a shocking bunch of rorts going on down there, which had to be changed. Yeah, Dougie Cameron. Yeah. Well, I worry about the criminal connections with the CFMEU, the whole McGatto fixing construction sites. The employers, the big builders, are also participating in that because it's just the only way to get things done. So I think there is a problem with corruption in the building industry, and the CFMEU is Australia's most richest union, and I think that the union movement as a whole has. Compulsory super has actually educated them a lot on, it's made them more financially literate. CBUS, the Construction and Building Union, now, you know, it runs $10 billion and they are looking after their workers super. And the great irony is if you go down to the corner of William and Burke Street, there's a brand new building which is almost finished, which is going to be IAG's head office. That has been developed by CBUS. They are the developer. So the building union in Australia has actually got to the point where they realise their own work practices are the big factor in negotiations on the economics of a new tower, and they can make more money for their own members doing it for themselves. So they still have these almost communist points of view of the workers building for the workers and making the profits and not getting ripped off. So I think there's a problem there. I think Rudd's good that he's a clean skin, that the first iteration of the IR policy would have been a disaster. The second iteration of the policy after the big mining industry backlash was actually pretty moderate and was actually fairly similar to quite a lot of work choices within there. Keeping the Building Construction Commission, good concession. So, I think overall it's not a disaster, but I think the criminal element, the Gatto factor, is actually probably almost the biggest worry. That there's a lot of associations. I mean, the police minister in Victoria today, Bob Cameron, in 2004, sat on a table at a Labor Party fundraiser with Matt Thomas, the guy who's just flown off to Singapore with Mick Gatto, Matt Thomas used to be Alphonse Gangitano's driver, and he beat a murder charge for stomping a bloke to death in Lygon Street in 1996. And in 2004, he was sitting at the table at a Labor Party fundraiser with the current police minister. And if you read the Herald Sun on Saturday, Fons Gancitano grabbed Peter McGoran, who was then a Howard minister, at a headlock and punched him in a prominent restaurant in Melbourne. So this whole culture of how does this happen in a normal Western modern democracy? It's just, you know, it's scary. So, you know, hopefully, if we had a corruption commission down here, I think some of this stuff would get stamped out. Hopefully the whole opus, the shock and the horror of Big Mick putting himself up as a legitimate alternative to the rule of law will hopefully shock Rudd into action to have a decent Royal Commission into Opus, which will then clean out a bunch of Opus's stiffy clients, which is laundering money, which will then lead to some much needed reform. So I've just defamed a whole bunch of people there. So
should I say Chatham House?
Yeah, Chatham House rules, yes.
Well, I would like to have the final question. Why do you do what you do? I remember this question came up when you last spoke to our group, and it has come at considerable personal cost to you.
I grew up in a family where my mum was very moral and church-going and always do the right thing, never tell a lie, all this sort of stuff. And my dad was obsessed with business and politics, so I had this weird mix of an ethical perspective on business and politics. I then got to see the grubbier side of politics firsthand as a 23-year-old inside the heart centre of the Kennett Revolution. And I also then got to see the downsides of sort of media power abuse, etc., by working for the Murdoch Empire for 7 years. And also got to, you know, basically formed a view about Australia's poor performance relative to where it should be on business. So the internet presented an opportunity to be able to say what I think, and just basically the independents have been able to say what I think. and campaign for what I hope think is benefits, holding people to account who hold power, and I enjoy it. I mean, I get a real kick out of driving things and saying things that will hopefully change things. But I think there is part of my mother's whole, you know, sort of, you know, always complaining about dodgy behaviour and wishing she could do something about it. So I think there's an element of that. And it's a lot of fun. Journalists love the thrill of the chase and, you know, snookering someone, exposing some crook. So you have that in your blood as well as a journalist. And I did lose my house for a while. We moved house 5 times in 30 months at one point. But, I mean, I sold Crikey for $1 million, which is a bit more than any regular garden variety journal will get. So, you know, it hasn't been all bad. And I get to meet interesting groups like this group. So, yeah, it's a real buzz. And I worry about saying things about Nick Gatto on the radio yesterday and stuff. But, I didn't sleep very well last night after that, actually. But it only lives about 1 kilometre away. So... yeah, but anyway, no, it's basically the thrill of the chase, and it's very satisfying to be independent, to do what you really believe in, and to not have any editor, lawyer, boss, proprietor, advertiser telling you you can't do something. You know, you must say something different. So not having to toe someone's party line is a very liberating and enjoyable operating environment.
Well, on that very optimistic note that you're still with us, Stephen, thank you so much for you've covered an immense area of ground today. So, Stephen, thanks so much.